This morning, we're going to be carrying on where we left off last Sunday, which is the other half of Mark chapter 10, as we continue our series in Mark's Gospel. And so I'm going to read from verse 32 to the end of the chapter. And it says this. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. We are going up to Jerusalem, he said, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later he will rise. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He said. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. You don't know what you are asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to become first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stopped and said, call him. So they called to the blind man, cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked him. The blind man said, Rabbi, I want to see. Go, said Jesus, your faith has healed you. Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. Some of you may know of me that I go to India fairly often. I say it used to be every year, but I haven't been for a couple of years now. And I go to a region of India, which is sort of two-thirds of the way down in the middle, and then head to the left, and you'll get to the east coast of Andhra Pradesh, in a little village, you don't have to sign this, called Nizampatnam. And there I go, and I take preaching trips, and I host pastors' conferences. You may not know that of me. I find this mildly amusing for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I am a woman, and in India, there are no women pastors. But because I am a white woman, I am an honorary man. So I can host a pastor's conference, but an Indian woman can't preach. Yeah, I don't get that either. But this is just the way that it is. And I probably give roughly the same talk at the pastor's conference every year, or at least some variant of it. And I preach on the three main temptations of Christian leadership. And some of these will be no surprise to you. Sex, money, and envy. You might be surprised by that last one, because it's a little bit less obvious than the first two. I mean, the joke always used to be, if a minister fell from grace and left a church and there was trouble, you'd say, was it the treasurer or the treasuree? But perhaps not. You see, envy is insidious. It can poison your ministry. It can cause you to become miserable, looking at everything and everyone but Jesus. It is tempting, and I know this temptation for myself, it is tempting to question why God is blessing the ministry of a colleague while you are faithfully struggling on with few obvious results. In recent days, though, I've had to rethink these three main temptations of Christian leadership. And that's because I've noticed a disturbing trend within Christian ministry. There seems to be a model of elite ministry, and I don't actually think that it's new, I just think I've run into it a bit of late. But there seems to be a model of ministry that takes God-given authority and wields it like a blunt instrument. Ministers who speak authoritatively in the name of God and do so in such a way that if you disagree with them, you are made to feel like you are disagreeing with God himself. I tried to think of a word that embodied that temptation, and the only one I could come up with was arrogance. And I don't know if anyone else, and this is something that I felt God say to me as I was being prayed for earlier, that there are some people here, I guarantee, or at least I feel that God is saying, that have suffered at the hands of people wielding power in this way. Words have been spoken. Lives have been hurt. There are wounds. And I believe that God would like to heal you this morning, or at least begin that process with you. So I guess that means I have four main temptations of Christian leadership: sex, money, envy, and arrogance. But I've been in Baptist circles for quite some time now, and I know that there are always only three main points. And if you're a proper preacher, these have to be alliterated. And I've thought about it, and I've realized this, that the root of envy and the root of arrogance are the same thing. They are both rooted in pride. I can't manage to alliterate that. If we are proud, we believe ourselves to be better than others, and that can lead to arrogance and the misuse of power, or it can lead to envy when we don't get what we think we deserve. Why do I mention this, you ask? Well, partly because for the first time in my life, I noticed that in the whole of Mark chapter 10, these three temptations are there. You see, in verses 1 to 12, which I skirted over like a professional last week, we have Jesus teaching on divorce and adultery. Last week, in verses 17 to 31, we looked at the rich young ruler's encounter with Jesus. He went away sad because he loved his money too much to give it up for Jesus. And today we're going to be focusing on verses 34 to 45, the arrogance of James and John, and Jesus' teaching on servant leadership. And now, you may not know this of me, I did a degree in maths, and one thing I learned about in maths was this: before you get to verse 35, there's verse 34. I studied a long time for that one. And so I want to have a look at the little passage before. Verse 32 to 34 says this: "They're on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and he told them what was going to happen to him. 'We're going up to Jerusalem,' he said, 'and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and he will hand them over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise.'" You know, this is the third time in Mark's gospel that Jesus predicts his death. And again, I sometimes think I'm a bit stupid. Again, this is something I hadn't noticed. Every time Jesus announces his death or predicts his death in Mark's gospel, there is an argument among the disciples. In chapter 8, verse 31, Jesus says that he's going to die, and the argument then is between Peter and Jesus. In 9:31, Jesus again predicts that he's going to die, and the disciples have a big argument over who's the greatest. And in this one, where Jesus gives the fullest prediction of what will happen to him when he gets to Jerusalem, i.e. where he is going right now, he gives this full prediction of what's going to happen to him when he gets to Jerusalem, and James and John cause a massive set too by trying to get one up on the other 10. An Anglican vicar called Richard Giles says this: "The jump from verse 34 to verse 35 reads like something out of a sitcom specializing in black humor. Picture the scene. A young mother makes a moving speech to her children, telling them that she has inoperable cancer and is going to hospital, never to reappear. And the kid's immediate response is, 'Mum, tell Wayne that it's my turn on the Xbox.' With equal sensitivity, James and John, evidently the theological equivalent of Janet and John, pipe up with all their requests for good seats at the grand reception when it's all over. They're callous, aren't they? Jesus just said, I'm going to get mocked, spat on, flogged, and killed. And they come up to him and go, Jesus, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. In other words, Jesus, we've written out this blank check here. Would you mind just signing it so that we can cash it in? Anyone with children no doubt has had a similar experience. Daddy, will you promise to do whatever I ask? Needless to say, Jesus doesn't make a blind promise, and it's always unwise for us to do so. Earlier in Mark's gospel, we can see an example of that. Herod Antipas made a blank check promise of up to half of his kingdom, having seen his stepdaughter dancing, and that resulted in his wife and stepdaughter requesting the head of John the Baptist be delivered on a platter. Common sense suggests that making blind promises is unwise, so Jesus asks James and John, what do you want me to do for you? Which is a question he asks the blind man, incidentally, as well. Jesus cuts to the chase and makes the brothers tell him exactly what they want before he agrees to it. So the brothers boldly petition Jesus in verse 37, let one of us sit on your right and the other at your left in your glory. They want seats of authority in the coming kingdom. James and John believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and they likely thought he was going to establish his kingdom when he reached Jerusalem. They didn't get it. These brothers wanted positions of the highest honor. To be seated at the king's right was to take the position of most prominence. The person seated on the left ranked just below that. James and John wanted the numbers 1 and 2 spots. They wanted to be the deputy prime minister and the chancellor of the exchequer in the new kingdom. James and John said, it's nice to make the top 12, Jesus, but we have higher aspirations than those other 10 guys. To James and John, life was like an episode of The Apprentice, and they are explaining to Lord Sugar why they should be hired over the other 10. They threw their friends under the bus. You do have to give them some credit, though. They still believed in Jesus. They were still prepared to follow him. And they still believed in his ultimate triumph. Misguided, insensitive, selfish, yes. But there was still an amazing confidence and loyalty there. You have to credit Jesus, too. He shows remarkable restraint when he deals graciously with such staggering insensitivity. And he asks them, he tells them, you don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? The cup and baptism. Immediately, our minds go to the sacraments, communion and baptism. And that's not wrong, it's just not the whole picture. The cup is an Old Testament metaphor for life's experiences, good and bad, that are given by God. The most familiar example of this is in Psalm 23, where the psalmist says, my cup overflows, in that case with blessing. But elsewhere in the Old Testament, God's cup is a cup of wrath or judgment. So the cup represents blessings or judgment as meted out by God on an individual. So when Jesus referred to the cup I drink, he was talking about his imminent suffering and death. This is the cup that Jesus pleads for God to take from him in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus also asks John, can you be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? He is not referring to water baptism. The word baptism means submerged or immersed, which is interesting that came up in that picture earlier, that we should be submerged or immersed. In this case, however, Jesus is asking, can you be submerged into the experience that I am going to have? Can you be submerged into suffering and death? We have an expression similar. So we say people are drowning in debt. It's the same kind of imagery. This word baptism or immersion was actually used regularly of being submerged in an experience. He is referring to his impending suffering and death, being submerged in pain and distress. It's not wrong to relate these things to our sacraments. For in both the cup and in baptism, we have a symbolism of death. For the cup represents Jesus' blood shed on our behalf. And in baptism, we align ourselves with the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ. So Jesus is asking James and John, can you suffer the same kind of suffering I'm about to enter into? He's asking them if they can handle the cross. They wanted a crown. He offered them a cross. And they say, we can. One author suggests that the only reason that the brothers reply in this way is that they don't have the faintest idea what Jesus is on about. We've all been there. These two brothers are self-confident in the extreme. Another example of someone who was self-confident, Muhammad Ali was a very, very confident man. He was on an aeroplane one day, preparing to take off, when a flight attendant asked him to buckle his seatbelt. And Ali said to her, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And the flight attendant quickly answered, Superman don't need no airplane either. James and John are exuding a similar level of overconfidence. And it's easy for us to fall into the same temptation, particularly if we have any sort of leadership or authority. It is tempting to fall into believing that you in yourself have the strength and authority to do what needs to be done. It is tempting to have that level of overconfidence. But we must keep in mind Paul's warning. Do not think of yourselves more highly than you ought. Jesus responds to the brothers' boasts by saying, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. There are two things to note here. Firstly, Jesus does not grant their request. I was reading about this passage of scripture, and one commentator says, God does not answer selfish prayers. And I thought, yeah, fair enough. And then I thought, actually, that's not right. That isn't true. God regularly answers selfish prayers. He just often says no. We have this misunderstanding of answered prayer. We think that God is not answering, whereas sometimes he might just have said no. I believe God has four main answers to prayer. Yes, no, wait, and do it yourself. God is unlikely to grant a selfish request, but if we're honest, a lot of us pray that way as we bring to God our shopping list of prayers. One preacher suggested that our slogan should be, ask not what you can do for your God, ask what your God can do for you. We pray selfishly, and then we complain that God doesn't answer our prayers. He does, as I say, he just says no. The second thing we can note from this is that Jesus predicts the suffering of these two brothers. It is interesting that James was the first apostle to die a martyr's death. If you were to look into Acts chapter 12, you will see that he dies by the sword and is the first of the apostles to do so. John, on the other hand, is the last apostle to die. And he dies in exile after a life of suffering persecution on the Isle of Patmos. These two brothers both suffer for following Christ. In Roman times, there was a coin, and on it there was a picture of an ox. And the ox had two things it could look at. It could look at the altar, or it could look at the plough. And the caption was, ready for either. And here we see with these two brothers, James got the altar. He died quite early on in his life for the kingdom. John got the plough. He worked hard for God his whole life, and he suffered for it. Are we ready for either? Are we ready for anything? After hearing the brothers' request, the 10 disciples became indignant with James and John. Not surprising. This is possibly because they thought themselves each worthy of the same honour. But before all this indignation escalates into a full-on brawl, Jesus gathers them together. This is early mediation. He gets them together and gets them talking. Well, rather, he gets them together and tells them what they're all wrong about. He says to them, You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. In these three verses, Jesus contrasts the world's leadership principles with God's leadership principles. The world demands respect through pride, power, and pressure. The follower of Jesus should exercise humility, grace, and service. In the world's economy, the greater you are, the more people you have at your beck and call. But in God's economy, greatness is characterized by the degree of service to others. I'm slightly disturbed by a trend that I see in church leadership, and that is to look and gauge our success on management books from the secular world. And there's a lot we can learn, for sure. But actually, we are not supposed to model our leadership on the style of Donald Trump or Lord Sugar. We're supposed to model our leadership on Jesus, and he laid down his life for us. Sometimes I think we try and bring models from out there in here, and then we wonder why, as the church of today, people aren't able to spot the difference. Interesting to note in verse 43, when it says that you must become servant, the word is diakonos, from which we get the word deacon. So deacons are those who serve the church. Our passage for today concludes with what I think are some of the most powerful and challenging words of the New Testament. Jesus says, "For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life as a ransom for many." Mark explains this is the purpose of Jesus' death. He gave his life as a ransom. A ransom, we'll think presumably of kidnapping. That's what I think of when I think of the word ransom. I think someone's been kidnapped and a ransom needs to be paid. But actually, this is a slightly bigger concept than that. Yes, it is true for kidnapping. It's also true for those who have committed a crime and financial restitution needs to be made, which in their system of justice would be okay. So money needs to be paid. A ransom needs to be paid to free that person from prison. Equally, people who are in debt, their debts need to be paid. So this ransom means the price. Also the price paid to free a slave and make them a free man. So ransom is basically money paid to free a slave, a captive, or a prisoner. And Christ gave his life as a ransom for all of us, for everyone. Jesus died in the place of others. He is our substitute. He is our example. If Jesus was willing to serve, so should we. The following principles I'm going to outline perhaps explain how we can model this brand of servanthood. The first thing I want to say is this. No, that wasn't just the introduction. The first thing I want to say is this. We should seek to serve others. Those with whom we are in relationship in particular, our children, our parents, our partner. The best place to begin service is at home. Make the dinner, take care of the kids, do the dishes, sweep the kitchen floor, clean the bathroom. This is a radical approach, could bring healing to some wounded marriages. A common cause of stress in marriages is that either one or both people selfishly want their own way. But when each seeks to serve the other, God can move in a powerful way. Seek to serve others at work, at university, wherever you are. This will repair relationships. This will build bridges. This will demonstrate God's love to those around you. Serve in the church. The local church is the bride of Christ, and she needs you. It is important that we try to serve in at least one area of ministry. Ideally, it should be an area in keeping with our spiritual gifts and passion. Find a ministry niche and serve as if the church is depending on it. B. because it is. Someone once called a pastor to say that he wanted to become a church member, but he went on to explain that he didn't really want to commit himself to attending worship regularly, giving to the church, visiting the sick, helping in Sunday school, or serving in any particular way. The minister commended him for his desire to be a church member, but suggested that his church might not be the right one for him. He told the man that the church he was best suited to was located in another part of town. So the man wrote down the address and hung up. Several Sundays later, the man arrived at the address and found an abandoned church building boarded up and ready for demolition. Serve the church as though it is depending on you, because it is. The church survives and thrives by servanthood. Every follower of Jesus has at least one spiritual gift given them to God, given them by God, that they might serve the body of Christ in some way. If you look at the lists of spiritual gifts in 1 Corinthians 12, it says that they are given for the common good, not for your own well-being. Someone once said the local church is like a bank. The more you put in, the greater your interest. Although today that illustration is a little lacking, because there's not a lot of interest in the bank, is there? So serve the church. And it's interesting, and I did not know this, but in Woody Weekly this week, there are a list of serving opportunities. It's as if we organised it, but believe me, we're not that organised. There are some opportunities there to serve the church. Prayerfully consider that. And then, finally, serve the community. Perhaps on your own, perhaps better together. There are infinite possibilities as to what we could do to help people if we work together. So my challenge this morning, I suppose, in my slightly scattergun approach at sermon planning today, is to consider firstly, if you are in any sort of leadership, the temptations that you face, to be wary of them, to be wary of the temptation of relationships that are not appropriate, of an attitude to money where we might confuse mine with thine. Be wary of arrogance and pride and envy, as they will poison any ministry that you have. Secondly, the challenge is to serve. I believe wholeheartedly that you cannot truly be a Christian in discipleship without serving in some way or another. Now, that really is entirely different for each and every one of us. We have different skills, we have different availability, we have different strengths, we have different passions. But the one thing we have in common is this: not one of us is exempt from the call to service. Serve at home. Heal relationships that way. Serve your friends, your family, your work colleagues. And serve the church. And through the church, perhaps, serve the community. And the thing that, as I say, I believe Jesus put on my heart earlier, as I was being prayed for, is that there may be some people here who have been victims of the misuse of power in the church. And I believe that God is open to healing us this morning if we come to him. Thank you.